the direct.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, the latest on health and healing, especially those who have pain, a different look at pain. Then I'm going to take a look at some of the questions or issues that you find important. And I'm going to address at least one of the topics, possibly two, from two of our callers recently about trying to identify the linguistics between those coming into the United States and what it means, since each one has something different that it can apply to and shouldn't all be categorized under one term. And I have some audio clips as well. But we begin always with the latest on healing, and this is from the University of Colorado, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Human Behavior, and it talked about pain and how it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. New brain imaging research shows that when we expect something to hurt, it does, even if there's no pain there. And this has been shown in study after study. For example, people who were told to be in an experiment, they were going to give a certain amount of money, and they were going to be burned with a cigarette. And they turned their head away, and they were touched, and they screamed. And indeed, not only did they get burned, but it blistered, and then they were shown that it was just an ice cube. Their mind believed it was something, and as a result, their body responded. Now think of how many times in life we say, oh, you make me sick. Or, you know, you make me sick to my stomach. You know, oh, you create heartache in me. All the things that we use without thinking there is a consequence. So what you perceive, you actually create in the body. Pain is one of those objects that millions of Americans have in real pain. But don't put things into your mind that you don't want your body to experience. Separately, a study from the University of Toyama in Japan, published in the Journal of Natural Products, shows that there's a rainforest vine that the ingredients in that vine starves pancreatic cancer cells. Now, this is important because pancreatic cancer cells are known for their ability to thrive under extreme conditions of low nutrients and oxygen, a trait known in the cancer field as austerity. The cell's remarkable resistance to starvation is one reason why pancreatic cancer is so deadly. But new research has identified a compound from a Congolese plant that has strong anti-austerity potential, making pancreatic cancer cells susceptible to nutrient starvation. And this is important. Now, pancreatic cancer is one of the deadliest forms of cancer, with a 5-year survival rate, no matter what therapy, of less than 5%. And because these cancer cells proliferate so aggressively, they deplete nutrients and oxygen in the region of the tumor. Whereas most cells would die under these extreme conditions, pancreatic cells survive by activating a cell signaling pathway called AKT-mTOR. And some researchers are testing plants for anti-austerity compounds that disrupt this pathway. And that's what a group of scientists found, an unusual alkaloid compound with anti-austerity potential from the vines found in the Congolese rainforest. Now they want to look for additional new compounds from twigs. And the vine, and I'll spell this for you, A-N-C-I-S-T-R-O-C-L-A-D-U-S, second word, Lykoko, L-I-K-O-K-O. And because some of you are scientists and physicians and you like to be at the cutting edge, and this is certainly the cutting edge, because the team extracted compounds from ground twigs and separate them by high-performance liquid chromatography. And then they characterize the 3D structure of the new alkaloid compound. And the research found that this new compound killed pancreatic cancer cells under conditions of nutrient starvation. So that is good news. And we always like to bring you what is at the cutting edge. It was many years ago that I was asked to do a race, and I was racing every week, sometimes twice a week. I remember one year I did 57 races, most of them championships. And this was in Central Park, and I was all set. And then I saw the sponsor of the race, and it was the artificial sweetener sponsor. And so I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do the race. I didn't make a big deal of it. Other people didn't mind. They didn't care who sponsored it. They were going to do the race. And it was aspartame. And later, when the meet director says, you showed up, but you didn't do the race. Why? And I said, because I've seen all the scientific evidence up to this point on aspartame, and I would never recommend anyone use it. It's deadly. Jump ahead. Harvard University, right now, yesterday, released a report that confirmed aspartame is linked to blood cancers, and that's a 22-year study. Now, Monsanto, which many consider the most evil corporation on Earth, it's now actually combined with another company, may be responsible for more chronic deterioration of human health than any other manufacturer of food and agricultural chemicals, from genetically modified crops to spraying them with the known carcinogen glyphosate, the main ingredient in Roundup weed killer, from nuclear weapons to Terminator seeds, meaning they die after 1 year so you can't save them, and from petroleum-based fertilizers to cancer-causing Agent Orange in Vietnam. So we've heard enough horrific Monsanto stories to last a lifetime. And now a 22-year study done on humans by researchers at the Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard University proves that aspartame, another Monsanto frankenfood creation, is responsible for health conditions, deadly chronic conditions, that most medical doctors blame on anything and everything but the real root cause. So isn't it time to know all the facts and learn all the research conducted? So let me just give you an overview now. This is the most concerning facts about aspartame. Deaths have been reported from aspartame consumption. Aspartame is made from the excretions of genetically modified E. coli bacteria. Aspartame is responsible for 3 times more adverse events reported by consumers to the FDA than MSG and GMOs and HFCs combined. Headaches and severe migraines are the most common sufferable conditions reported. Seizures, including epileptic ones, have been reported, especially when aspartame is consumed on an empty stomach, and that you would do if you were drinking a soft drink. Aspartame consumption is linked to weight gain. Its consumption is linked to chronic depression. Its consumption is linked to compounding asthma problems. It's found in more than 5,000 products. It's the most consumed synthetic sweetener in the United States. It's comprised of 40% aspartic acid, 50% phenylalanine, and 10% menthol, which is wood alcohol. And aspartame is genetically modified in a laboratory. And excitotoxins overstimulate human brain cells until they die. And aspartame depletes serotonin, the natural hormone that controls anxiety. And the dangerous combination of aspartame's ingredients convert into formaldehyde, which is a highly toxic embalming fluid for the dead. And that can accumulate in your body. And aspartame consumption is linked to prostate cancer, to breast cancer. It's known to dramatically feed other cancers, including worsening brain cancer, enlarging tumors, according to a Harvard 22-year study on humans. Aspartame can cause and exacerbate irritable bowel syndrome. And men who consume more than one diet soda per day increase the risk of developing blood cancers, including multiple myeloma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And leukemia, which is another blood cancer, risk is heightened when men and women consume diet sodas containing aspartame. And aspartame fuels metabolic syndrome. So, all the reasons why we shouldn't consume this artificial sweetener or the products that it's in. From Loughborough University in the United Kingdom, published in the Journal of Applied Physiology. You can't exercise? A hot bath can help improve inflammation, metabolism, and other conditions. That's correct. Hot water treatment may help improve inflammation and blood sugar, which is your glucose levels, in people who are unable to exercise. And physical stress, such as exercise, can cause the short-term elevation of inflammatory markers. But after exercise, the level of inflammatory chemicals rises. In the process called inflammatory response, this activates the release of anti-inflammatory substances to combat unhealthy high levels of inflammation, known as chronic low-grade inflammation. And recent research has shown that raising body temperature augments the inflammatory response, which has provided a rationale for identifying alternatives to exercise to reduce low-grade inflammation in the body. So, something to think about. Also, from Johns Hopkins University, a study that asked a basic question. Is the rise in blood pressure with age a consequence of the Western lifestyle? Let me just give you the bottom line. A common belief in cardiology is that blood pressure increases with age. That's a belief, although studies find little evidence of that among non-Western adults in isolated communities. But does the association between age and blood pressure differ in two isolated communities with different levels of Westernization? In this study, researchers examined the association between age and blood pressure in two communities in a remote area of Venezuela in the rainforest, inaccessible by land. The Yanomami community is made up of hunter-gatherers, gardeners, who are among the least assimilated people in the world. And the Yekawana people live near the Yanomami, but they have been exposed to missions and an airstrip has allowed for delivery of medicine and other features of Western lifestyle, including processed foods and salt. Well, blood pressure measurements were taken for 72 of one and 83 of the other participants between the ages of 1 and 60 years of age, and it was done on a regular basis over 5 months. And researchers found no age-associated rise in blood pressure, whereas there was an age associated with the more westernized exposure. So here is the takeaway message. It is not aging in and of itself that causes blood pressure to rise. It is the westernization of our lifestyle, including our diet. From the University of Aegean in Greece, blueberries prevent chronic disease by reducing inflammation in the body. Now, there are a lot of foods that are now called superfoods, and most people don't know all of them, but blueberries are certainly one of them. And according to the research published in the Natural Products Journal, researchers looked into the effects of blueberry consumption on humans and the list of benefits that accrue from that, and looked at all the studies over the last decade, and it's impressive. All of these studies revealed that eating blueberries increases cognitive and vascular function, as well as insulin sensitivity. They also found that it plays a useful role in preventing cancer. So that's very important. It reduces free radicals, which reduces inflammation. And so this was also seen at the University of Laval in Canada, who recently explored the anti-inflammatory properties of blueberries. they zeroed in on the high bush variety that is common in North America. And then they looked at the proanthocyanidins that it contains and said, ah, that's it. They also found that the blueberries not just turn off inflammation, but decrease the growth of bacteria. So, in the Journal of Nutrition, in the Journal of Complementary and Alternative Medicine, all these journals are showing blueberries are wonderful. And especially important are for people with Alzheimer's or dementia. And it lowers the risk. So a cup of blueberries a day keeps your brain active, keeps Alzheimer away. And also, from the University of Georgia, in Athens, Georgia, the same compounds that give plants and vegetables their vibrant colors can also bolster brain functioning in older adults. So, bold colors boost brain function. That's the takeaway message. That would be your bright colors, red peppers and yellow peppers, the red cherries and raspberries and strawberries. They're rich in lutein and xanthan, and they help the brain. So the more vibrancy in color in the diet, the healthier you are. And finally, today, how exercise could help fight drug addiction. University of Illinois, the journal ACS Omega, we have a lot of drug addiction in the United States and drug usage. And returning to the environment where drugs were previously taken can make resistance that much harder. However, addicts who exercise appear to be less vulnerable to the impact of these environmental cues. Now, research suggests that exercise might strengthen a drug user's resolve by altering the production of peptides in the brain. So, the more you exercise, the more your brain becomes resistant because of the levels of these peptides. In effect, you're giving yourself some dopamine hits. And one of the reasons people keep going back to sugar, alcohol, drugs, is because it gives them a dopamine hit, gives them that dopamine high. And that's important. So exercise creates endorphins, which is a natural opiate. And so if you did a 45-minute exercise in the morning, you've got about 6 hours where you're just going to feel better. That's good. That's the latest on Health and Healing. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside.
We are going to go over now and say hello to Elizabeth, who you, when you send your information, questions, challenges, comments to prnstudio@gmail.com, she reads them and then she comes on the air and shares them. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Gary. We have a lovely letter here from a lady who wrote to you, and it begins, she has just celebrated her 97th birthday. She takes a 5-mile walk and does yoga for half an hour, meditates daily, and goes out on her bicycle. But she says you probably won't remember her, but she met you when you were a young apprentice with Sarah Doner at the Writers Literary Agency. They were part of a large group who would come mostly every night to discuss world events, and all were social radicals, mostly all authors and academics, and Sarah and others were there. Some of them were in their 80s and 90s, so the men were too old or sick to have been in the Vietnam War, but they were part of the peace movement. Anyway, you were a very quiet one, editing your manuscript, she says. You sat there for 8 to 9 hours. You never said a word, and she thought you must be very shy. Sarah had told them any health questions and they could ask you. But she was in her mid-40s, so she didn't have a health question, but others did. So she enjoyed witnessing the exchange between you all. She was a professor at the time. She got your book back in 1972, and she still has it today, and has been a vegan since that time, following the health principles you gave. She moved back to Tennessee, and she and her son attended your lectures when you were there, and she shared your information with whoever was interested in her own teaching. And she says that all in that teaching room over the 40 years ago have all passed. All her fellow high school graduates have passed, and fellow college mates. And she is still here, healthy, with no illnesses. Her mind is sharp as a tack, and she has you to thank for that. She finished by saying that you remind her of Alvin York, and to PS that she'll let you know when she reaches the big 100. So that's great. And the question is, do you remember this lady, and can you tell us who Alvin York is?
I didn't hear your last comment.
The question is, do you remember this lady, and can you tell us who Alvin York is?
Alvin York, yeah. Alvin, A-L-V-I-N, York, his middle name was Colum, C-U-L-L-U-M. He was one of the most decorated soldiers in the Army in the First World War. He's from Tennessee. He was known for being a marksman, and he had converted to Christianity. And he found himself between a rock and a hard place because he was serving his country, but he was serving without the idea of killing anyone. And it was only in a battle where they were in the trenches, the Allied forces, and the Germans held the high ground in these what were called boxes, pillboxes, and they had machine guns, and he saw how many people were getting killed, and he had that epiphany that he had to do something to stop the killing, otherwise thousands of people could be killed. And so there were small detachment of soldiers, they came in behind, surprised, and captured. So the few people in his platoon, I don't know how many, I'm going to guess 6, 7, he told them to stay there, and then he went around the flank. And to do that, he had to expose himself in what was known as no man's land, meaning you're really in a bad place. There's no protection. There's no place to hide. And yet the Germans were not looking in that direction because they thought that would be a suicide. They were looking straight ahead and down, and they were gunning all the people who were in the trenches. So he managed to get up and got to a higher point than them, and then he took aim, and as he was a marksman, every time one of them stood up to shoot the Americans, he'd shoot them. And once he shot all those who were handling the guns, he went over and he saw an officer, and the officer surrendered. Then he had the officer hold up his hands and tell the people, he said, now in German, you tell all these other soldiers to give up their guns, the war's over for them. And they went down the hill, and one group from one trench would surrender, then they would join others, and next thing you knew, he's marching with, I think it was 122 people that he personally had captured. And they marched to the back lines, and when one of the higher officers, I believe it was an English officer, American officer, said, where'd you find these? He said, well, I got them. You got them? You personally got them? He said, yeah, I got them. They found that hard to believe. And then when they said, well, how did you do that? And he said, well, I had to, unfortunately, and against my faith, I had to kill some of them. And he shot 22 of them. And but he was one of these kind of, oh, shucks kind of guy. Very simple. What in the South, or at least in the Mid-South, near the Mason-Dixon line, Tennessee, Kentucky, West Virginia, we call good old boy. And these are very low-keyed, self-effacing people. And he didn't want anything. He just wanted the suffering and the war to be over, and it was, and he came home. But they didn't allow him to go back home because they started seeing the political benefit of this very simple lifestyle guy who wanted nothing for himself. He had all these offers. And he turned them all down. He said, no, I just want to go home. to the hills west to the hills of Tennessee, and but they took him around the country before that, and he did some speeches, but he wasn't a very good speaker. And when he got back to Tennessee, he was legendary. Everybody knew him. And he was poor. His family was poor. And so what they did, the people of Tennessee put together a fund and built him a farm. And so he went home and lived on his farm. So that's who he was. And all people in Tennessee are proud of him like they would have been for other people in other communities. So do I remember her? There was one person there who was so much younger. She was half the age of Sarah Doane and her colleagues. And just so people have a context, I took a job. It wasn't for 8 hours a day. I did it in the evening after my daughter was asleep. There was a person who I was helping with her health who would in turn make sure that my daughter was fine when she was sleeping. I would go down to 72nd Street to the Bancroft Hotel, and up there she had her apartment, and I would do editing. And the idea was I wasn't to be paid. That was an internship. In return, once a week she would help me with my own work so I would be able to improve. And because I was a very fast writer and didn't have a block, I was able to go through a lot of manuscripts. And she was about 82, 83 at the time. But all of her friends would come at night. And in time, I would listen to their conversation because I'm, you know, 10 feet away from them. And though I didn't interfere in anything they were saying, I did not have their intellect or historical knowledge. I'm a kid. I'm young and naive and ignorant of the world. But these people were extraordinarily insightful. They were Trotskyites and Marxist communists. They were all radical left. But they had all had their day. And when you realize that they had been born in the 1800s and they had fought through women's suffragette and all the other major movements up through probably the 1950s, and now they were old and they were just, they would talk about how they would approach the anti-war movement. And there was one who was half their age, and that's probably who this person was. But she never asked me a health question. The others did, but never took my advice. And Helen was, or Sarah was, considered the Maxwell Perkins of her time. And he was a great editor who helped Thomas Wolfe take untamable manuscripts, like 3,000 or 4,000 pages that nobody could decipher, that were unpublishable, and he would boil them down, and he would craft from those the essential story. And Wolfe was not the nicest guy in the world. He was not just a contrarian. He had a distempered personality, and he never appreciated how much this man, his editor, did for him. By the way, he helped a lot of other very famous authors as well. And that's how Thomas Wolfe got his best-selling book, his first of two. And she was the same. She had incredible talent as an editor, writer, and she worked with some of the most famous writers in the world. So that's the environment that I was in, and it was interesting to see. So I'm glad she's 97. I never know, you know, when I'm talking or doing a show or writing a book, who's going to read it and who might be influenced. But the fact that something good came from that all those years ago. And what's important, what she said was everyone from her high school was passed. Everyone from college that she graduated passed. And also that she's completely healthy with no illnesses. That's terrific. And so that's the model that you look at, the person who does it right. And then something that I've shared with this audience, and I'll share it again in case it slipped your mind. We are led to believe that we will only know the truth of our choices and their veracity when we reach our destinations. I believe that if we use intuition and acknowledge our spirituality, we don't have to make mistakes to get to a place where we say, wow, look at all those mistakes we made, shouldn't I have done it differently? We'll see the traps and the pitfalls and the lost opportunities or the wrong opportunities and be able to act accordingly. And if you only had one out of 1,000 that did it right, it shows how to do it right. It's like, if you had 20,000 UFO sightings that were all shown to be false and one was real, you prove they exist. So you don't have to have 100,000 people do something right in order to prove that it can be done. All it takes is one. So if you can reverse Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or ALS in one person, you prove it can be done. And that's what she's really identifying. And I haven't heard from that person in all those decades. I'm glad that she wrote me, and I look forward to 3 years from now when she's 100 and seeing how she's doing then. Now we're going to hear from George Carlin, because we had an extraordinarily articulate person who called in, and to summarize what he said that he recognizes that there are people who are on many levels failed, but he also says that what we're faced with now, the tyranny of this functional illiterate who's the president, an illiterate in every way, with no redeeming value whatsoever. I can see no redeeming value at all. Better to have someone like a Hillary Clinton, who is running again, by the way, and will get the nomination, unless Sanders gets it. But it's better to have her than even accepting that you have the lesser two evils. That's a completely legitimate argument to make. When we come back, I'm going to have George Carlin begin what I will complete in that argument. I will share with respect to this gentleman, and I appreciate his asking us to consider that point, which I have. I will ask him and those who supported Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or Bill Clinton to consider a different argument.
Now, there's one thing you might have noticed I don't complain about. Politicians. Everybody complains about politicians. Everybody says they suck.
Yeah.
Well, where do people think these politicians come from? They don't fall out of the sky. They don't pass through a membrane from another reality. They come from American parents and American families, American homes, American schools, American churches, American businesses, and American universities, and they're elected by American citizens. This is the best we can do, folks. This is what we have to offer. It's what our system produces. Garbage in, garbage out. If you have selfish, ignorant citizens, you're going to get selfish, ignorant leaders. And term limits ain't going to do you any good. You're just going to wind up with a brand new bunch of selfish, ignorant Americans. So maybe it's not the politicians who suck. Maybe something else sucks around here. Like the public. Yeah, the public sucks. There's a nice campaign slogan for somebody. Because if it's really just the fault of these politicians, then where are all the other bright people of conscience? Where are all the bright, honest, intelligent Americans ready to step in and save the nation and lead the way? We don't have people like that in this country. Everybody's at the mall, scratching his nose, taking his credit card out of his fanny pack and buying a pair of sneakers with lights in them. So I have solved this little political dilemma for myself in a very simple way. On election day, I stay home. I don't vote. I don't vote. Two reasons I don't vote. First of all, it's meaningless. This country was bought and sold and paid for a long time ago. The shit they shuffle around every 4 years doesn't mean a thing. And secondly, I don't vote because I believe if you vote, you have no right to complain. People like to twist that around, I know. They say, well, if you don't vote, you have no right to complain. But where's the logic in that? If you vote, and you elect dishonest, incompetent people, and they get into office and screw everything up, well, you are responsible for what they have done. You caused the problem. You voted them in. You have no right to complain. I, on the other hand, who did not vote, who, in fact, did not even leave the House on Election Day, I'm in no way responsible for what these people have done and have every right to complain as loud as I want about the mess you created that I had nothing to do with. So I know that a little later on this year you're going to have another one of those really swell presidential elections that you like so much. You'll enjoy yourselves. It'll be a lot of fun. I'm sure as soon as the election is over, your country will improve immediately. As for me, I'll be home on that day doing essentially the same thing as you. The only difference is when I get finished masturbating, I'm going to have a little something to show for it, folks. Thank you very much.
Okay. I understand the jest in it and his logic. I do believe in voting. The difference is I would never, under any circumstance, vote for the lesser of two evils. Could you imagine the people of the world voting between Stalin and Mao or Hitler and Mussolini? You're going to get hammered, but what about the third-party candidates? Now, when I look at Ralph Nader and Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson, I see people who are on the right side of history and the right side of issues. Virtually all of the important issues they've supported, virtually none of these issues has Hillary Clinton supported. But I want to be very specific. Because if you suggest that we vote for Hillary Clinton or someone like her, like Barack Obama, then are you willing to be responsible for the choices they make in your name? And that would be true for the people who voted for Trump or for George Bush Sr. or Jr. or Ronald Reagan. You have to, at some point, accept that if you helped a person get into positions of power, and you did not do your homework about what they really represent and who selected them before you elected them, then you cannot simply say, I'm not culpable because I was misinformed. No, you were intentionally ignorant on it. So here is the reality of Hillary Clinton, why I did not vote for her, and why I would not suggest you accept this in the future, even knowing that a third-party candidate will certainly lose. But had we accepted that they're going to lose, but we build sustainable platforms with true progressive ideals, then long ago we would have had a viable third party. So by kicking it down the road saying, well, they can't win this time. Okay, so they can't, and they can't win next time. But at least you have 4 or 8 years you can build on that and educate people. It takes more discipline and it takes more patience. But here are the specifics. I'm going to give you what Ralph Nader said yes to and Hillary Clinton said no to. Repeal the worst labor law, the Taft-Hartley, which intrudes on free speech. Nader, yes. Clinton, no. Halt nuclear energy. Yes. He's going to halt it, Ralph Nader. Hillary Clinton, no. Support nuclear energy. Reduce hydrofracking to protect public lands. Nader, yes. Clinton, no, supports hydrofracking. Continue with fossil fuel. Ralph Nader says no. Hillary Clinton says yes, let's subsidize the gas industry, the nuclear industry, the hydrofracking industry, and the oil industry. Clean coal. Nader said that's stupid. Clinton says yes. Offshore drilling. No. Nader, and no to Bernie Sanders. A carbon tax, it should happen. Clinton said no. Taxes on speculative trading, Clinton, no. A moratorium on GMOs, stop GMOs. Clinton said no. Repeal the DARK Act and mandate GMO labeling. Clinton said no. Reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act that her husband and her helped to destroy. Clinton says no. No, say no to all these treaties like the TPP and the TTP. She said, no, I'm for these treaties. Reform and repeal NAFTA and CAFTA. She said no. Lessen whistleblower policies. She said no. be able to let Julian Assange go free because nothing he's been charged with had been shown to be true. She said no. Yeah, okay. Legalize marijuana. She said no. Universal health care. She said no. Breaking up the big banks. No. Repeal the Patriot Act. No. Sever support to Saudi Arabia. Absolutely not. Dramatically reduce defense budget. No. Normalize relations with Russia. No. Oppose Israel's apartheid of Palestine. No. Decrease the arsenal of nuclear weapons. No. Cease aggressive threats against China. Not in your life. Stop NATO containment of Russia. No. Yeah. And free public education. No. Get all the money out of politics. No. And stop allowing the pharmaceutical company to charge anything they want. No. Mandate all vaccines. Ah, she says, yes, I want to see vaccines mandated. More the better. Reduce the militarization of law enforcement. She said, no. Overhaul the National Security Agency surveillance illegal of Americans. No. Reform public airwaves. No. Free public college education. No. Reduce support for charter schools. No. Reform the judicial system. No. And LGBT rights, tackle the problem of discrimination. She said, not nationally. So, everything I just mentioned, Ralph Nader, was just the opposite. So, remember, that's what she actually did. But then you have today, you have the consequences of her being Secretary of State and an influence to Obama. But I'm going to go back to her husband because from all accounts, from people who were working with the Clintons, she was really the president. He was the good old boy going out and shaking everyone's hands and the nice persona to the public. She was the brains. So here's what happened under the Clinton administration that, again, she didn't change from then in the 1990s, early 90s, till 2016. Under Bill Clinton, approved the first genetically engineered food product, the GBHG, or GBGH, opened the doors to GMOs as sustainably equivalent to natural foods so that the FDA would say, well, no, we don't have to test it. They're both the same. They are not. It was under Hillary Clinton that they started the welfare reform policies that ended up diverting funds from welfare programs to private interest, including private prisons. That was under Hillary Clinton. So if you really want to support Hillary, why don't you speak to 1.5 million African Americans and other people of color who were thrown off welfare because of their greed and who they want to align with? The Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act, almost exact from Newt Gingrich's contract with America that launched, that scrapped a lot of aid to families on welfare. That was also them. Launched the first major child immunization program at federal level to increase immunization compliance, even though there was no science supporting it. Ratified NAFTA, gutting the U.S. manufacturing section, causing millions of American labor unions members to lose their jobs and closing thousands of plants. Head Start, setting minimum educational standards that has led to the debacle known as the standardized testing today. The three strikes crime bill, and you can spend the rest of your life in prison. Greatly expanded the war on drugs, particularly in international arena in Colombia, leading to furthering of the paramilitary violence in FARC. The largest rate of incarceration under any president in history. She was the one who had the lock them up and throw away the key philosophy. It was also believed that Reagan had the same philosophy, but she put it into action. Improved America's School Act, continuing of education reform policies that further nationalized the model of one size fits all. Ratified GATT, Religious Freedom in Schools Act, enabled religious-minded people to pray and practice their faith in schools a bit ambiguous, but it no longer allowed the separation of church and state. She also expanded by 60 crimes the Effective Death Penalty Act. And the Defense of Marriage Act, which was a conservative victory passed in 1996, she supported that. The military operations in Yugoslavia and the Balkans, Samoa, all political. She supported it. Return to Cold War mentality. She reneged on the Bush-Gorbachev agreements by expanding NATO on Russia's borders. She expanded sanctions on Iraq. And as a result of her sanctions, 500,000 children died. Now, I want you just to stop for a moment and just think of that alone. If it's nothing else, if someone was responsible for causing 500,000 children, innocent children, to die who didn't need to, and that was under the Clinton administration, they're responsible, wouldn't that disqualify them from anything in life? Shouldn't that make them susceptible to crimes against humanity trials? And her own, she actually served in two positions, Secretary of State and also U.N. Ambassador to the U.N., Madeleine Albright, said on 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl, was it worth it, the death of 500,000 children? She says, yes. Well, what kind of person would say, yes, it's okay to kill 500,000 people? Also, the war in Rwanda, the genocide of almost 900,000 people, could have been stopped instantly, and yet she and he kept that going. And also, his second term was actually much worse in foreign affairs. The National Defense Authorization Act under Obama, in his second term, she did not challenge that. The mishandling of the Arab Spring completely blew the opportunity. She supported the tyrants, particularly in Libya and Egypt, as did Joe Biden and her State Department, but they did not oppose it. She was in a position to oppose it. She was behind the coups and regime change in Honduras, Libya, and Paraguay. She allowed the increasing of the National Security Agency spying on Americans under Obama. And under Obama, the CIA spying on the Senate. That's something J. Edgar Hoover would have done. An executive assassination and drone wars, where it became just a matter every week of, I think it was on a Tuesday, he would have his kill list meeting. Here's who we're going to kill. Is there any due process? There's no need to. Under the National Defense Authorization Act, no one has to be tried, no evidence presented, no habeas corpus. If the president wants you dead, you die. Over 11 million people have left the workforce and unaccounted for, and fewer at work today than in 2000. The DREAM Act, which increased the H-1B visas to foreigners, causing people who had worked their whole life to get to a place of seniority and some stability to be thrown out of work. That was under Obama. And the passage of TARP and other bailouts didn't help a single American, but helped their friends on Wall Street and in big industries. The greatest rise in inequality and have and have-nots through that term. And a cash for clunkers. It was $1.4 million spent for every job it created. They gave $25 billion to General Motors and Chrysler instead of letting them go through structured bankruptcy. And also, it was under Obama taking billions from Medicare to put into Obamacare. He completely bungled the British Petroleum Gulf oil spill in its cleanup process. And that's just a few of the things that happened where, if she had character and did not support him, she should have let us know. And I went back and checked, and there were over 500 campaign promises between 2008 and 2012. That never got attention because they were never honored. Militarism, for example, the promise to get out of Afghanistan and train Afghan forces to replace us. Now we still have, in our 17th year, in fact, just this year, we've dropped more bombs in Afghanistan than any other of the 17 years. And now the Taliban is in control 60% of the country. So she is the one, along with Obama, that promised a new beginning for nuclear weapons. Over $1 trillion new and improved nuclear arms race. What could possibly go wrong there? and we destroyed Libya for gold and for them wanting the gold denier to be the new currency instead of America, as dollar, in the trading in Africa. And now you have slaves being sold in the open market for $400 each. That's Obama and that's Hillary Clinton. So they promised to close Guantanamo. It's still open. So you see, now they want a new Cold War, and Hillary Clinton has positioned that she would not be afraid to launch a war against Russia, China, and Iran. We can't beat the Taliban in Afghanistan after 17 years. We would have our ass handed to us in any conflict with Russia and China. And yet we had no problems intervening in the Ukraine, the Arab Spring, Egypt, Libya, Honduras, Paraguay, and now Yemen. And Yemen is under her. So when you see 29 million people starving to death, when you see those photographs of men and women and children especially, who are just bones with the glazy death eyes, that's Hillary Clinton's child. That's her war. She's the one who supported Saudi Arabia, gave them the largest military contract in history. The white phosphorus used, we supplied it. The war planes, we supplied it. The aerial reconnaissance supply, boots on the ground, we supplied. It's our war also, our genocide. That's her genocide. So you want to support that as the lesser of two evils? Somehow I'm having a hard time realizing how outside of personalities there's a difference. Promising transparency, ethics, and information, there was no transparency, ever. Promising to tighten up on lobbyists and former federal officials, never happened. All promises, all of them broken. Promised single health care, didn't happen. Obamacare was written, the entire process was written by the insurance industry. And promised to cut family insurance premiums, $2,500, actually increased them. Promised to reform the Veterans Administration, it's in dire straits now. It can take up to 5 months to get seen by a doctor. And sometimes care could take up to 2 years. So what we are dealing with is we're dealing with people who want it more hydrofracking. They believe that there's such a thing as clean coal. They believe in gutting American jobs. They believe in doing business with the worst terrorists in the world. Yeah, they believe in GMOs, but not organic. They didn't stop a single home from being foreclosed on. 7 million homes were foreclosed. 21 million Americans lost their homes. It could have all stopped by having the President of the United States issue an executive order and going to the banks. They bailed out all the banks. They bailed out Chrysler. They bailed out GM, but not a single American citizen. And they were against the occupation of Wall Street movement. And on immigration, I played you a clip. And Hillary Clinton's husband, before the entire legislature, said that he would put up barriers and prosecute people. So did Obama. But now that no one's looking back to see what did these other presidents do. So they want to prosecute whistleblowers and journalists. More people were indicted under Obama for treason, and the only treason was that they told the truth about corruption in the government. More people went to jail. And the assassination of U.S. citizens, which was codified into law. So think about that before you say, let's select the better of two evils. No, it's still evil. It's bad to the bone. We're out of time. I don't have time to address the other issues. I will. I'll go through what differentiates the different people coming to our country and how we might perceive it in a different way. This coming Sunday at noon, I'm going to be doing, I'm guessing, three hours. But it's going to be the most definitive look at our environment, the likely scenario, what's happening and how quickly it's happening. the worst places to live, including New Jersey and New York. This is a new report just out today, by the way. Just came out today. Florida, North Carolina, Texas, New Jersey, Delaware, and New York. Those are your five most susceptible places, and they're not sustainable for the future. So why can't we get anyone to change? Why can't we get people to move? Why can't we be honest about how severe the problem is? Because that's not the way our mindset works. So I'm going to be doing a discussion on this in depth and helping people prepare for the future. There are decent places to live. There's ways to protect yourself, even if you can't move. I'll be going into this in great detail. Go to prn.fm. That's prn.fm. And join me Sunday at noon for what will be one of the most important conversations and webinars I've ever had. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.